From WXXI News, I'm Evan Dawson, and this is Connections. It is rosé season for a lot of us, certainly for many people in the Finger Lakes wine industry. Though, to be fair, winemakers will tell you that there's not just a season for rosé, that rosé is something you can drink all year round. But certainly, when the weather gets warm, you might be thinking of changing it up a little bit. And the Finger Lakes wine industry is getting ready to celebrate one of the best events of the year. It's called the Rosé Soirée in Geneva, and it is quite a party. We're going to talk to three different winemakers about planning this event, about rosé and why the category is growing on the business side. And we'll also talk about the business of the Finger Lakes wine industry in general, from recent weather issues to getting new accounts in Manhattan and beyond. We'll talk Finger Lakes wine and the Rosé Soirée this hour on Connections.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Anger is mounting over security checkpoint delays as millions of people prepare to travel out of town for the long holiday weekend. Today, a top executive with American Airlines testified before Congress that airport screening delays at the nation's airports have caused more than 70,000 American Airlines passengers to miss their flights. And Kara Filipovich says they were not alone.
This year alone, over 40,000 checked bags were delayed in TSA screening and did not travel on their scheduled flight.
Her testimony to a U.S. congressional subcommittee came a day after the head of the Transportation Security Administration testified about how his agency is trying to cut down the lengthy wait times at checkpoints that have caused widespread disruptions this spring. After weeks of being called the de facto nominee when his rivals dropped out of the Republican presidential race, Donald Trump will formally be announced the GOP nominee at this July's convention. NPR's Asma Khalid reports that an Associated Press count finds Trump has secured enough delegates required to secure the nomination.
Trump now has 1,238 delegates, according to a tally from the Associated Press. That's one more than the 1,237 magic number a Republican needs for the GOP presidential nomination. Trump got to this point because 29 unbound Republican delegates told the AP they plan to support the business mogul at the RNC convention. Those delegates come from a mix of states, and this suggests Republicans are beginning to unite behind Trump as their candidate. Trump was widely expected to reach the delegate threshold after primaries on June 7th, but he got there sooner than expected. He'll become the official nominee at the Republican convention in Cleveland this summer. Asma Khalid, NPR News.
Europol director Rob Wainwright says Europe is facing the most serious security threat in decades from its own citizens who've been radicalized. Terry Schultz reports the head of Europe's police agency estimates more than 1,500 foreign fighters are back in Europe after fighting with ISIS and other extremist groups.
Europol chief Rob Wainwright says at least 5,000 European citizens have become foreign fighters in Syria or Iraq. Wainwright says governments must have a plan to deal with those who return, which he estimates to be a third of them so far. Some of those are in prison, some in rehabilitation, but some, Wainwright warns, have violent intentions toward their home countries, such as the Belgian and French citizens who staged the Brussels and Paris attacks.
And there are others, potentially, that could pose an equal danger. And that's a serious terrorist threat, the most serious that we've seen in a generation in Europe.
Wainwright says despite the threat, European governments are still only sharing about half the data they could be to fight terrorism. For NPR News, I'm Terry Schultz in Brussels.
The Dow is off 41 points at 17,810. This is NPR News. The U.S. Navy is investigating today's collision between two U.S. Super Hornet jets that collided off the coast of North Carolina today. A Navy official tells NPR the event was characterized as a mishap. All four crew members on board the two aircraft are reported to be safe. France is mired in chaos as the government and a major union remain at odds over a labor code revision. NPR's Eleanor Beardsley reports there are still gas shortages as CGT union members block the country's oil refineries.
Laurence Grant is lined up with other drivers at a Paris gas station waiting her turn at the pump.
The thing is incredible is that a few, because it's a very minority, can block everybody like that, you know. It's just incredible.
But the CGT union says the majority of French people support their actions. Polls have shown that around 60% of the French believe the labor code overhaul turns the clock back on social progress and will make workers' lives more precarious. But it's not clear whether the public supports the continued hardline response of the union. CGT union members working at the country's 19 nuclear reactors walked off the job, joining truckers, dockers, and rail workers. Eleanor Beardsley, NPR News, Paris.
Crude oil has topped $50 a barrel for the first time in nearly 7 months. Traders are welcoming this increase as a good sign for the global economy. U.S. stocks are slightly lower. The Dow is off 39 points at 17,811. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News.
Support for your public radio station comes from our members and from Lucas Greenhouses in Fairport, serving the Rochester region for more than 30 years. The nursery offers locally grown plants, from annuals and perennials to vegetables and herbs. Lucas Greenhouses, grown right here. LucasGH.com.
From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Well, our connection for this hour was made last October, when the Finger Lakes wine industry was in harvest mode. Grapes were coming in, press pads were humming. It's a time of year that can be fun, or stressful, or often both. And this past October, more than any I've ever seen, there was one problem in particular. Ladybugs. Yes, ladybugs. The bugs can burrow into the grape bunches for warmth, and if they get through to the crush pad, they can do ugly things to a finished wine. Think funky peanut butter, not the aroma you want in a Riesling or a rosé. And so harvest crews did the kind of work that most consumers never see and have a hard time fully appreciating. They plucked the ladybugs out, one by one. I was part of a crew volunteering that pulled out 300 ladybugs from a single half bin of grapes. Here's why I started with this story. That is just one example of the challenges that crews face in turning grapes into beautiful wines. It is always something. There is, of course, the weather. Recent winters have done damage to buds, and total production is down, but quality is not. And after recent frost scares, we are finally enjoying a stretch of weather that should set up the region for a wonderful growing season. Perfect timing. The Finger Lakes wine industry is getting ready to celebrate one of the best events of the year, the Rosé Soirée in Geneva. Finger Lakes Public Radio, WEOS, is once again a media sponsor of the event on Linden Street. And this hour, let's talk some wine. We'll preview the soirée, we'll talk about why rosé is a growing category, and we'll talk about the health of the industry in general. Let me welcome my guests for the hour. And they include Kelby Russell, the winemaker of Red Newt Cellars and KJR. Kelby, welcome.
Thank you, Evan. Glad to be here.
Peter Beecraft is here, the head winemaker for Anthony Road Wine Company. Peter, welcome to you as well.
Present.
Nice to hear you. And Julia Hoyle is the assistant winemaker for Sheldrake Point Winery. Julia, welcome to you as well.
Hi, Evan.
Well, we're making sure that everybody can hear us because all three of them are in our broadcast partner studio, WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM. So they're down there in Geneva taking a break from their busy schedule and to join us about talking about the soiree. So I will start with the man who I was first in contact with. That's Kelby Russell about the soiree. It is June 4th, which is, I think it's two Saturdays from now, 5 to 9 on Linden Street. What is the idea? What's the genesis and the reason for this party? Kelby, tell us about that.
Well, the initial genesis was just to showcase Linden Street and to showcase Finger Lakes wines. This was at a time when some people knew about Linden Street, but I think in general it was a hidden gem. There was a lot of potential there, and it was kind of seen as a chance to really show off Linden Street, show off this sort of European street fair idea that we'd come up with to showcase dry rosé, which at the time was kind of an insider wine. It looked like it might actually explode, but it hadn't happened yet. You know, there weren't articles about it in papers. So it was just to have a good time, really to make an event that we jokingly said would be one that the industry would like to go to. So often these events become so mobbed that it's not necessarily fun to be there pouring. And this is the one event that I have people emailing me from wineries asking how many people they can send to pour because they have so many requests within their own staff.
Very good. And so this is the third year now, Kelby?
That's correct.
All right, third year for the soiree. Again, 5 to 9, two Saturdays from now, on Linden Street in Geneva. And listeners may be sick of hearing me talk about Linden Street, but I've said on this program in the past, when we had the program about our favorite streets, it's my favorite street in the Finger Lakes. It's got such a great feel. And if you go to the website, and I had it in front of me. Kelby, what's the website for the Rosé Soiree?
I believe it's FLX Rosé Rising, or it might just be roserising.com.
I know, and there's something else. There's a couple. We'll figure it out. The bottom line is if you Google Finger Lakes Rosé Soiree, you'll find it. There's some beautiful images of this street. It really is a gem. Kelby is not overstating that one bit. It's a great, great scene. But you got to get tickets in advance. So, Kelby, first of all, kind of give us a sense for what you expect in terms of attendance, how many wineries will be pouring there, some of the scene with music, food, and how people can attend.
Yeah, so tickets at this point just purchased online through the website. There were some that were for pre-sale around Geneva, but those are all snapped up, and there will be 50 available at the door. We're expecting about 650 people. We're pretty close to sold out as it is, but it should be a great time. We're going to actually take up the entire street this year. The first couple of years, we used about half the street or two-thirds of the street, so it wouldn't feel too empty. But we're using the full street. We're going to have 28 wineries, which might not be every Finger Lakes winery producing a dry rosé, but we've got a good chunk of them covered now. And then a few food vendors, both the local restaurants on Linden Street as well as the Red Dove Tavern's going to be doing some fresh-shucked oysters, which is a great compliment for rosé, that's for sure. And a few other different restaurants are going to be coming out and partnering up. It's a real collaborative event. I think it reflects the spirit of the industry and also what we're hoping to accomplish here in Geneva.
All right, well, let me ask Julia then, because Kelby kind of gave the game away that there are so many events that winemakers have to go to, big events, big crowds, and, without saying, Kelby's not saying it's a drag, but he's saying it's not always, the best night of your year, and this is an event that is different. Well, but Julia, he also says there's going to be 650 people there. That's kind of a mob. So do you agree with Kelby? Do you look at this as something that's kind of different, something that you do look forward to and mark the calendar on?
I absolutely do. And actually, Dave Breeden, who's the head winemaker at Sheldrick Point, he asks me about it before we even know when the date is. It's a lot of people, but it's a lot of people that are there for a very specific wine. You're drinking, you're going to have a good time, but the past couple of years, it's always been large. And we've never run into the issue of, multiple people so very drunk that instead of having a good time with your colleagues and then the people that are coming up to you to talk about rosé, you're more focused on, is that person about to destroy a piece of property? It just doesn't have that vibe. And maybe that's because it's about rosé. I don't know. But everyone dresses in pink and we just have a good time.
Yeah, I have said in a past life, when I volunteered to pour behind the bar at Fox Run one summer, a special version of hell is when a bachelorette party shows up and then another bachelorette party shows up at the same time. That's the fear in the eyes of the people in that room was really something to behold.
The pink boas are usually when you see the stray feathers. That's usually
Though Julia, the pink boas may be good to wear to the soiree because people actually wear rosé, don't they? I mean, there's a lot of pink.
They do. Yes, I don't love pink, and I every year have to go buy an outfit specifically for the rosé soirée because I will not own the color pink otherwise.
And Kelby is your spouse, and he is always deaded up in something quite swank, isn't he?
I have an entire rosé wardrobe. I'm all set.
I'm not surprised at that. Peter Beecraft, head winemaker of Anthony Road Wine Company. Peter, your wine company is one that has been pouring in Manhattan for years, down at Union Square and John Martini's been going down there for years. So your winery, maybe even more than most in the Finger Lakes, has experience going far and wide to pour and reach customers. How do you view the soiree, having been to so many of these kind of events?
The soiree is the event. That's the event of the year. That's the event that winemakers look forward to. And for a tasting event, for serious tasters, novice tasters, this is a great way to get introduced to the winemakers, to drink wine and eat food amongst the winemakers, and to taste the Finger Lakes' biggest growing category of wine. I mean, rosé is I feel our next Riesling. It's the next wine and wine category that's getting the foot in the door of those restaurants in New York City.
That's an interesting point, because I mean, I was going to save that for a little later in the discussion, sort of the breaking into new markets and where the region is going. I always like to get a snapshot of how that is going, because that's just going to be an ongoing process that never really ends. But Peter, that's not something that I sort of expected. I mean, I'm not surprised to hear that Rosé is making headway in bigger markets in Manhattan, but does that mean restaurants, are they calling you and asking for it? Are you bringing it to them saying, take a look, and then they're thinking, well, maybe we'll pour it by the glass? How is that usually going down?
Yeah, all of the above. Yeah, all of the above. You mentioned a previous question, the market. We've been going down to the Union Square Green Market for now over 20 years. That's John Martini, my boss, goes every weekend. Sometimes every other week we do another one in Queens, in Jackson Heights, and we'll be doing a third one in July and August at Rockefeller Center. That is a big, big market for us. New York City appreciates rosé. You have a very cosmopolitan population that's traveled, that understands rosé. That understands that the pink wine is not going to be sweet. We're talking about dry rosé. Through that, through the market, we have, the market for us is great because the people in restaurants, they come and shop for their produce in the market. And so they get exposed to our wine there by tasting it. And that has been a big avenue for us getting into restaurants and wine shops. Trader Joe's is right around the corner. That's our largest client for rosé.
You're hearing from Peter Beecraft, the head winemaker of Anthony Road Wine Company on Seneca Lake. Also with Peter in our WUS studios in Geneva, Julia Hoyle, the assistant winemaker of Sheldrake Point Winery, and Kelby Russell, the winemaker for Red Newt Cellars and KJR. And Kelby sent me a note saying, I don't always mention KJR, but it's relevant this one, KJR being your own eponymous label there, Kelby. And it's relevant in this one because you're making a dry rosé, and you're making a really, really good one, I have to say. But you also mentioned that this is a growing category. So let's talk about what dry rosé is and sort of why it's been growing, because if we have listener questions, it's a great time for that. If you want to know about the winemaking process or anything else related to it, we got three great winemakers to help you with that. And you can call the program toll-free, 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI. If you're in Rochester, 263-9994. You can find us on Twitter at Evan Dawson or our producer, Megan Mack, MMack Media. You can always email me, edawson@wxxi.org. Kelby, the simple question, Peter mentioned rosé being dry for years, of course. I don't know if stigma is the right word, but the expectation was that pink wine is sweet wine. What is rosé? How do you make it?
At its base, rosé is a red wine made in a white wine style, or red grapes made in a white wine style might be the best way to think of it. So you're starting with grapes that have red skins or pigments of the skins, and then some amount of skin contact right before going to the press and pressing off, as if with white wines, for the most part, we're getting the fruit in to the winery and then pressing it off more or less immediately and then dealing with the juice. So in this case, we're dealing with red grapes that we're pressing off after some amount of time, kind of mingling with the skins crushed up, leaching some of the color and some of the flavor compounds and other things that might be in the skins, then pressing off as a pink juice, and that's how you end up with a pink wine in the end. But the question of sugar, I mean, that happens in the fermentation process. And I think what has the bugaboo for rosé is that White Zinfandel and these blush wines became really popular, and there's no problem with those wines in the least, but they led to this expectation that pink was going to be sweet when, historically, far and away, rosé, if you think of the south of France or anywhere in Europe that it was made, was always dry. And that's been a bit of a learning curve. I think the Finger Lakes has decided to double down on wines that people expect to be sweet between Riesling and rosé.
All right, so maybe I can quiz all three of you in your own respective wineries, and I don't know if you're armed with stats, but in generally speaking, Kelby, I'll start with you. You're making how much rosé annually now versus how much a few years ago? And some of it, I'm sure, it has to do with sort of what's available, and I know we'll talk a little bit about the weather, and the last couple of winters have done a little bit of bud damage that has been irksome, but The demand. Let's talk about that. You're making how much now versus how much before, and how much demand you're seeing for rosé. Kelby, you first. Go ahead.
Sure. We didn't make any before 2013, released in 2014. So we were at zero at that point. We're at this past year was 500 cases. We'd actually been hoping for 1,500, if that gives a better sense.
And that's for Red Newt you're talking about?
That's correct.
Okay. And your own eponymous label, how much are you doing?
Oh, sorry. That was my label.
Oh, there's that
no,
was yours. Okay.
No Red Newt rosé. Yeah, sorry.
But Red Newt, is there a rosé from Red Newt?
There is not.
Okay. Well, maybe you should rectify that. But I don't want to. I don't want to tell you or Dave how to do business. No, I joke. But okay. So there's a sense for Kelby's side. Julia Hoyle, the assistant winemaker at Sheldrake. How much rosé are you guys doing?
Currently, this past vintage is about 2,400 cases. And I started with Sheldrake a little under 3 years ago, and we were about 800 cases.
Wow.
3 years ago. We've been making rosé since the first vintage in 1997, but it has clearly grown since then. And we were able to grow as much as we have because we're all estate-grown fruit, and as we saw our numbers going up, we gave, you know, a year's advance notice or 2 years advance, depending on the client, saying, you know, 2 years from now, we won't be able to sell you any of our Cabernet Franc grapes. We need them for ourselves and this growing market. So we only processed 1 ton of Cabernet Franc for red wine this past vintage, and everything else went to rosé. So,
and I got to say, Julia, and this is no hyperbole here, I love the Sheldrake rosé. I actually haven't encountered a rosé from the Finger Lakes in a long time that I just thought was no good, which is a testament to the quality of the growing and the winemaking and sort of just the approach to rosé region-wide. But the Sheldrake has been so good. So two different times. Last year, we visited some friends, and they had a rosé. It was Sheldrake. It was fantastic. Last, let's see here, 2 weekends ago, visited some friends. They were pouring Sheldrake rosé, so apparently everyone is pouring your rosé right now. And
that's good news.
I will say last year, my son, we let him smell the wine. He always wants to smell it and maybe get a tiny little taste of it. And most of the time, we always ask him, what does it smell like and what does it taste like? And, you know, last year he was three, and most of the time he says it smells and tastes like whatever's on the plate. Or sometimes whatever he's looking at, he'll be like, it smells like a stop sign. And I'm like, you're looking right at a stop sign. You know, it doesn't. But he actually said about the Sheldrake rosé, he said it smells and tastes like watermelon. And I was like, yes, that is a great note. So what's
super
your...
Super taster.
There you go. So my wife and I looked at each other like, wow, that was a really cool little moment. What's your tasting note on your current release rosé, Julia?
Well, if you read the back label, it's all sort of floral notes. For me, it's a lot about sort of fresh strawberries, maybe touching into sort of some lilac and those really aromatic florals. But for me and palate as well, it's a lot about fresh red fruit. It's not bone dry. There's just a touch of sugar. It's under 1% if you're thinking percentages or 10 grams. So it's still very much in the dry category, but there's just enough to sort of up those bright red fruit flavors, raspberries, strawberries, watermelon, perhaps.
Maybe a little, maybe it's the whisper.
Yep.
Very good. Peter Beecraft, head winemaker of Anthony Road Wine Company. How much rosé are you guys making now? And you've been at Anthony Road for a good while now, and how much, you know, has that changed?
Yeah. 10th vintage for me. And in 2006 is when Anthony Road made their first rosé. We make a rosé out of Cabernet Franc, and we will also blend a Lemberger into that as well. We started in 06. I'm guessing, Evan, that we probably did about 250, 300 cases. And this past year, I have two rosés, a small production rosé that goes under our Gray Series line, and then our regular rosé, and we bottled 1,135 cases, to be exact.
All right, so we're talking about a big increase in the last decade. Peter, you're not making wine that you don't think you can sell, so obviously your customers are asking for it. And there's never a single moment in wine where, you know, you can say today is the day that the world realized the Finger Lakes makes some of the best Riesling in the world, or today is the day the world realized X about wine. I mean, it's a process over time. But was there You know, is there a reason that rosé as a category is getting the respect it is from our region, or was there any sort of a moment where you thought, boy, they're taking it much more seriously now?
Yeah. Yeah, that growth has happened within the past 5 years for sure. There's another event called Discover Dry Rosé that takes place in the beginning of the winter, early spring. And it's mostly for the trade and in media. And that started maybe 4 years ago. And I think there were a handful, maybe 10 at the most. And the last event, I think there were maybe over 30 wineries about that participated. It just shows you the increase in production in the region. And you mentioned something earlier that with Finger Lake Rosé, there really isn't one that you've encountered that is not good. And that tells you something, because you could say the same thing for Riesling as well. And when you come across wines that are very consistent and very delicious to drink, you begin to understand what you can concentrate on and potentially should concentrate on from your region. Play to your strengths.
Yeah, absolutely. Julia, for you, is there any sort of a change moment or a story that you can recall about rosé that indicated to you it's getting the serious recognition that has taken a while and it's been sort of a long time coming for it?
I guess the biggest thing for me is, again, what I think both Kelby and Peter have touched on. You know, for a long time, pink wines were sweet, and I think that, you know, the youngest generation of wine drinkers is also the highest percentage of people drinking wine regularly than ever before. And I just think there's a large young population that has discovered rosé and that it's not White Zinfandel and it's not a sweet pink wine. And, you know, sort of coming of age and drinking and wanting to have something that's dry and fun and something to open up on a summer day, I just think there's a whole new generation of wine drinkers that have discovered it. And I think that's helped a lot, especially down in New York City. You know, what's trendy is trendy, and that's how you build a market.
Okay, but let me go back to Peter Beecraft, because, you know, Peter, you mentioned that you've got restaurants that are inquiring about it, that, you know, obviously in a region that has, how many bonded wineries now? Maybe like 125, 130 in the Finger Lakes region, something in that range. You know, most are not going to have a long-term success just selling out of the tasting room, though some can. But certainly you want distribution and you want to find your way into other markets. And if restaurants, take Manhattan, but you could take any major market, if they're selling your wine, they think they could sell it probably year-round. I mean, maybe you sell more rosé in the summer. That's probably natural, though I'm sure I'll get some angry looks for even mentioning that, because I know it's a year-round wine. But do you have restaurants that are selling it year-round now and that it is becoming a staple, or is it seasonal still?
Yeah. Yeah, year-round. Year-round. But it does dip off a bit. I mean, the busy time is spring, summer, into early autumn. In many respects, rosé is treated much like the launch of Beaujolais Nouveau, where there's springtime's here, rosé's here. It's time to, you know, drink this, and the weather's going to be great. And then, you know, at the end of the summer, you move to red. But what you don't understand is that rosé is just a classic, refreshing wine, also an amazing food wine that goes with a host of pretty much everything, from light salad to roasted meats. And you'll find so many different styles from our region, whether, you know, the grape variety makes a difference. You'll find Pinot Noir rosé, you'll find Merlot, you'll find Sangiovese, Lemberger, Cabernet Franc. We have, and also Cab Sauv sometimes. We have a whole host of grapes that really, really do well for this style of wine.
I'm looking at fingerlakesrosé.com. So that's where it redirects to. So there you go. If you want to check it out and check out the pictures there, there are some pictures of Linden Street that will, I sound like such a fan or sort of a Geneva fanboy, but there are some breathtaking pictures here. That street is so beautiful, and that's where the Rosé Soiree is on June 4th, two Saturdays from now, from 5 to 9 p.m. FingerLakesRosé.com to get tickets, and as you heard earlier, it is probably going to sell out, and soon. They're expecting more than 600 people there for that event, so if you want to attend, get on it now. Let me grab a phone call. This is Michael in Naples. Go ahead, Michael.
Hey, Evan, how are you? Thank you for taking my call.
Sure, good.
great subjects. I work for Diane and Tim Mullard and Sclermore Winery.
Oh, very good.
And we're on our, I believe, our fourth, possibly fifth vintage of dry rosé. It's a Blau Franc-ish. It's awesome. Zero skin contact type, so it's got nice pale color. But the reason I was calling is I've been to all the dry rosé events that happened in March, and it has grown. I think, as you said, it was over 30 this year. And in the very first year of all the winemakers and winery owners and everything, the newspaper quoted me, just a guy that works in the taste room one day a week, as saying, if somebody looks at the wine and says, I'm not drinking that because I don't drink sweet, I almost force them to drink it. Because people look at that color and they just think sweet. And does anyone else have these problems or help people get around that?
Michael, stay on the line. It's a good question. You guys run into that at all? Peter, Julia, Kelby?
I'm happy to chime in real fast. I was just at an event at the Culinary Center in Canandaigua this past Friday, and I had a couple of people that said, oh, I really don't need to taste that. And I said, oh, well, are you expecting it to be sweet? I said, well, it just always tastes like White Zinfandel to me. And I said, well, that's not correct, so you should probably just try it. And, you know, it's always that awkward situation where you don't want to be aggressive and be like, well, actually, you're wrong. But you say that nicely.
Well, the Sclermore Winery is kind of a funky place. I have kind of an obnoxious personality. So sometimes, not being the owner, I take the liberty of maybe telling people, no, you need to try this. And many a time, they were so surprised and they end up buying it. But it's just so frustrating to have people just look at the bottle and turn away from it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're getting a lot of, I think, solidarity there, Michael. And thank you for the phone call. Inspiremore does really neat stuff, too. And he's calling from Naples, down at Canandaigua Lake, where you'll find Inspiremore Winery. But at least it sounds like that is becoming less often the case, that certainly you've got some people who still see a pink wine and they think sweet, or they think White Zinfandel, or they think, like I did in college when I was thinking, I've got to do something super, super high end for my girlfriend tonight, and what's the only great wine out there? And you know, I was 20, and I said, oh, it's White Zinfandel. Yes. So look, there's an evolution that happens, and that's what's going on here. We're taking more of your questions. If you want to call the program, it's 844-295-TALK, toll free 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI 263-9994 if you're in Rochester. Richard writes to the program, Evan, I really enjoy dry Riesling and from the three wineries who are with you today, but dry rosé, how would their dry rosés compare to a dry Riesling from each of the wineries represented today? Kelby Russell's the winemaker for Red Newt Cellars and for KJR, his own eponymous label, and Richard wants to know how does a dry Riesling compare to a dry rosé? Kelby?
It really reflects the personality of the winery style. I think each winery has a certain style for their dry Riesling, whether it's a little bit richer and more voluptuous or whether it's a little leaner and snappier. And these are all correct. And I think you see the same thing with dry rosé. I think it surprises people. It's not just the grape that can change, which has a huge impact, but also how you decide to work with the wine and what you're looking for in your finished wine. So my dry rosé stands out in that it is bone dry. I mean, it's really lean, it's really tight, really quite snappy. And I think you'd probably expect that tasting, you know, the Red Newt dries or the dry Riesling under my label, which are very similar in terms of, you know, acid structure and the balance point. But I think that I don't want to speak for the other two winemakers.
Well, Julia Hoyle, assistant winemaker at Sheldrake Point Winery. Richard wants that comparison between your Riesling and Rosé.
Absolutely. And I think Kelby hit the nail on the head with it. Certainly Sheldrake's dry Riesling is not as dry as certain wineries. We let our fruit get a little bit riper, so there's just this richness that's there. And similarly, our dry rosé is a rounder, still dry, but a rounder style rosé. So less about high acid, actually tends to be a fair bit lower acid than some others, and that lends to that roundness and that really sort of soft fruitiness. And similarly, our dry Riesling is that way.
Okay, Peter Beecraft from Anthony Road.
Sure. First of all, let me just say, what a great question. What a great question. And I'm glad that Kelby went first. you know, in our situation, our dry rosé, it tends to be a bit fuller, maybe a bit bolder. I like a heavier body type of rosé as opposed to something light. I like a rosé that can start the evening, but also can extend way into the evening. The you know, concentration of berry, the hints of herbs, still ours are dry. So I think the one that we have in the bottle right now, we have the two that we have. One is probably bone dry. The other one is maybe 5 grams of residual sugar. Also, I like a little bit of texture, a little bit of tannin, not overbearing, but just enough to kind of get some textural on your palate there. Kind of makes your tongue kind of salivate. With the Rieslings, kind of the same thing. I think our style has been a fleshier Riesling. It's still cut and defined with acidity, but we do tend to bring out some of the luscious, not necessarily tropical, but sweet, citrusy type of aromatics and flavors with nice minerality through both of them, with acidity that doesn't sting but extends the palate.
Peter, your first vintage at Anthony Road was what year?
2006.
Okay, so just about a week ago, I was digging through the basement. I was going to say the cellar. It's just a basement is what it is. I came across a bottle of 2006 Anthony Road semi-dry that I did not know I had, which is like, I mean, that's like better than finding a 20 in your jeans when it comes through the wash, you know, because, and it was, you know, it was well stored. So I decided, I said, well, usually, you know, you kind of lay stuff down and you save it, but I didn't know I had it. So, you know, we're going to have to drink this tonight. And it was really outstanding.
That's fantastic.
You know, have you had much from your first vintage in a while?
Recently. We've had a couple people visit the winery, and we needed to dive into the library to present some wines to them. So, yes, we have. And 06 was a great year. Great year, not all around, but a great year for Riesling.
Yes, enough time has passed that you can now say that, without fear of sort of any repercussion, that that's not the most celebrated red wine year in the Finger Lakes. But
sure.
The 2006 was just outstanding on the white wine side. So really cool stuff. We're going to get a break. We're going to take more of your questions. We've got some questions about rosé itself. A caller wanted to let us know it's 2 Saturdays from now. I think that's what I've been saying, but just in case I was unclear about the rosé soiree, it is 2 Saturdays from now, which means it's a week from Saturday. And that is the 4th from 5 to 9 p.m. on Linden Street. That's the rosé soiree. Go to fingerlakesrosé.com if you want to check it out. See some pictures that look like they were totally color corrected and manipulated, but I think those are actual pictures. That's how beautiful that street is. It's my favorite street in the Finger Lakes. It's a really neat place, and they're going to have more than 24 wineries pouring rosé, live music, and just a really neat scene. The 3 winemakers on our panel today agree that this is, for a lot of the winemakers in the industry, their favorite event of the year, and it's become that way. Should have more than 600 people there. So let's get a break, come back, get more of your questions, and talk a little bit more about the health of the Finger Lakes wine industry at large with Peter Beecraft, Julia Hoyle, and Kelby Russell, winemakers in studio at WEOS Geneva this hour. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections. You've heard of STEM, but have you heard of STEAM? We're talking about how they're trying to put art into STEM to create STEAM. So science, technology, engineering, and math gets a little bit of an artistic bent. And we'll talk to the University of Rochester about why they want to bring art into STEM. That's Friday on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Great to have 3 winemakers in studio at WEOS. Finger Lakes Public Radio, our Geneva studio down there, 89.5 FM, and WEOS is once again a media sponsor for the Rosé Soiree. I know they're always proud of that, and Kelly and Greg and the folks down there who do such great work every day are thrilled to be partnering with that event. That event's coming up 2 Saturdays from now, June 4th, so that's a week from Saturday, and still a few tickets available, we think, though judging by this conversation, that might not be the case by the end of the hour. I'm not exactly sure. A couple of questions, a couple of comments here. Chris on Twitter says, love having Geneva Pride on Connections. Shout out to Linden Street. Anna sends an email and says, Evan, I'd like to know, your winemakers have been talking about the process, but can you use white grapes to make rosé? Okay, Kelby, Julia, Peter, Anna's question, can you use white grapes in making rosé? Don't all jump in at once. Go ahead. Coming to you, Peter Beecraft.
Yeah. Yes, there is a grape. Called Pinot Gris that will give that has a darker skin when it's fully ripened. It is purplish, dark reddish color. You could soak on the skins and leach colors there. That's the one that comes to mind for me. But also, white wine could also be used as a blending component. Not necessarily the component to take to make a red wine pink, but a pink wine, you could add blend in white wine, let's say Riesling, to bump up aromatics, to give liveliness to the palate, things like that.
All right, I want to talk a little bit about the weather that that you guys are having right now. I hope everyone's in a great mood with the stretch that we're in now. And I know bud break has happened. I think we're past the frost threats. And hopefully what this signals is the start of a wonderful growing season. And you guys are on your way to a great harvest this year. The last few winters, this was not the raw winter this year that we had the last couple. But I think it's important for our listeners to understand, you know, one of the challenges of winemaking in the Finger Lakes is that, you know, you may occasionally get stretches of temperatures in the single digits below zero, or if you get to double digits below zero, that can do a little bud damage. Really extreme ones can do vine damage, but we've seen some bud damage the last couple of years, which means lower production for some, if not most, Finger Lakes wineries. I know there was one day where temperatures ended up a lot lower than expected this year in the winter, and there was some concern about bud damage. I don't know how much you've been able to sort of determine in terms of possible winter damage from that event and how things are going to be this year. Kelby, I'll start with you. What are we seeing in terms of damage, if any, from the winter, and how are things looking in terms of overall production capacity this year?
Sure. There's certainly some damage. That night was Valentine's Day night, or going into Valentine's Day.
Oh,
so
it's okay.
An easy day to remember. And I remember waking up just about every hour checking the weather underground weather stations. Red Newt sources grapes from both sides of the lake, of Seneca Lake, I should say. So I was checking different weather stations almost in horror as it kind of dropped from the -6 they were expecting down to -12 or even lower to some spots. After a really mild winter that normally we wouldn't have worried too much about any bud damage. So everyone was kind of on pins and needles. Everyone was waiting to see what it looked like. I think we're still, you know, the truth that any grower will tell you is that we still don't know. But we're past bud break now, and we have a good feel for at least some things. I think Chardonnay for a lot of people got hit a little bit harder than the last couple of years. Chard had been one of the ones that pulled through really nicely in the past two really hard winters, and maybe because it was warmer and it was a little further advanced in coming out of dormancy back around Valentine's Day, it got hit by that temperature swing. Gewurztraminer for some people looks like it got hit a little bit worse than others. Riesling for us, the Riesling vineyards that I look at, you know, we're looking at maybe 4.5 tons an acre is kind of our current guess, which is down a little bit from the 5 that we might normally shoot for. But that's certainly, that's a rounding error when you're talking about agriculture. And then, you know, kind of paradoxically, the things that you might think would be the most cold sensitive, Cab Sauv, Cab Franc, at least with the vineyards that we work with, those were the ones that did the best with that night. Again, probably because they were just so dormant still that they were super chilled and not bothered by the cold weather one way or the other.
Okay. Julia, what are you guys seeing at Sheldrake Point?
Over at Sheldrake, we didn't get quite as cold as some other sites. If any of the listeners have been out to Sheldrake Point, it's right on the water, so that is a big help when we get the cold snaps. Merlot had some bud loss, but everything else was within range of what we would expect in a normal winter, whatever that means. 15% or so bud loss, which that's okay. The biggest thing for us is we did do a lot of replanting last year when we had vines die, so the entire vine, not just some bud loss, in those two cold winters. So it's a couple of years till some of our Riesling and Cabernet Franc blocks are back up to what they would have been at 4 or 5 years ago. But we replanted because we feel very confident that those vines will do fine. And we will get cold snaps again, but not enough to destroy the vineyard in any way.
Okay. Peter Beecraft from Anthony Road Wine Company.
Sure. At Anthony Road, we have two sites, the Martini Family Vineyard, which is right by the tasting room, right by the lake, and the Nut Road Vineyard, which is right across the street on Route 14 and about a half a mile down the road from us south. The stories between the two vineyards are pretty telling. The vineyard closest to the lake by the winery there fared the best, although Chardonnay from that site and the Nut Road site did take a hit, whereas Kelby had mentioned the years before, it fared really well. And actually, I was telling people, you know, the real cool climate grape is Chardonnay, you know, because it didn't get affected by the last couple winters, which were extensively longer cold. This year, we've hardly had a winter, but it was that Valentine's Day weekend at our farm, it got to negative 11. That's pretty cold. Merlot. Yeah, Merlot does not like that. Merlot, I don't know if we'll have a crop at all. Gewurztraminer took a hit. Chardonnay did. Pinot Gris as well.
Pinot Grief.
Pinot Grief, as Kelby says. And Peter, Kelby mentioned kind of getting up every hour on the hour, checking temperatures. Can you describe what it's like when you're going through, especially this winter? You know, you guys, if anybody deserved an easier winter, it was the Finger Lakes wine industry this year, coming off the raw winters of the last couple of years. And, you know, for the most part, it had been pretty simple, simple relative term. But then you get this stretch where all of a sudden, you know, one night is a lot worse than they thought. And can you kind of tell me what the emotion is like as a winemaker when you're just in that time and feeling like you're not really in control?
Yeah, well, that's the thing. You're not in control. And for a vineyard manager, it's even worse of a situation. To tell you the truth, going to bed that night, it was supposed to be maybe negative 5. And then when I woke up in the morning, it was negative 3. And then I got to the winery to find out that it got to negative 11. So it got a lot colder than was predicted. And, you know, there's not much you can do. You can have wind machines that can kind of move that cold air so it doesn't sit in spaces, especially little dips in the topography that you have. Where the cold air likes to hang out, that can help. But, you know, it's agriculture. You're dealing with Mother Nature. There's only so much that you can do.
Peter, do you get the sense now that, you know, nobody deserves anything? I mean, weather is weather. It's going to do what it does. But after the last couple of winters, we're in a great stretch now. Again, like I said, hopefully it sets up a great year. I mean, do you almost feel like you're owed a 2012 type year? Is it about that time? How do you feel about it?
Evan, we deserve greatness. Yeah. I'm thinking about that. I'm thinking so far the spring and the winter have reminded me of 10 and 12, which have been really, really stunning years for both reds and whites from the region. Earlier, you know, our thing is, you know, we're a cool climate. That's very relative around the world. There are cool climates in Napa. But our season is shorter, and our winters can be more severe than most wine growing regions anywhere in the world. That is something that we deal with, and I think it makes us stronger. We never have a vintage that is the same, and because of that, I think as winemakers and vineyard managers, we have maybe more tools in the toolbox. We've experienced more problems. And it helps us make consistent and better wines because of that. It's an exciting place to make wines, and it's an exciting place to drink our wines.
All right, well, let me get a couple of listener questions in that have come in via email. Right on cue, here's Emily. Emily wants to know if climate change is having an impact on the Finger Lakes wine industry. My guess is Peter, Julia, Kelby. Emily's not the first person to ask this question, but I will let you guys answer however you see appropriate there. And I don't know who wants to start, but go ahead.
Sure, it's definitely having an impact. I mean, things are warmer. We're dealing with warmer years than we used to, which, you know, on net, we probably wouldn't complain about. I think the thing that when we're talking about climate change, when you see articles on it, the thing that's really scary is the extremes. It's the swings that are the bigger issue for the wine industry compared to sort of a long-term trend. So it's not so much that we're thinking about planting, you know, more Syrah in the Finger Lakes right now. It's more that, you know, we can have a nice mild winter and then all of a sudden have a minus 15 degree night out of nowhere. Or, you know, we can have a stretch of weather in March for 2 weeks where it's in the 70s and 80s and all of a sudden we have to worry about bud break, you know, 6 weeks ahead of the last frost date. So if anything, it's adding to apprehension. I mean, it'd be nice if we were just warming up so much that it wasn't an issue. Or I mean, maybe that wouldn't be nice. But, you know, it's kind of putting us into a little bit more of a danger zone sometimes.
Julia?
Yeah, I guess just quickly adding to that, I feel like no one, you know, you talk to people that have been farming, whether it's grapes or just other crops, and multiple times I've heard people just say, you don't know what the normal is anymore. What is norm? What is the normal for growing grapes? You know, what weather should you expect? And nobody really seems to know. We are not, sort of going off of Emily's question, we're not necessarily having drought issues in the way that you would hear about grape growing regions on the West Coast. We're still, we have plenty of water. But what is normal for us in a growing season is not really known, just kind of rolling with the punches.
Peter Beecraft?
Yeah. Duck and move. Duck and move like a boxer.
Well, I have to say, guys, I remember maybe 4 or 5 years ago now talking to some scientists at Cornell who said almost exactly what Kelby said, which is that climate change is, it's probably going to push the ceiling up in terms of overall average temperature. And, you know, that's sort of logical. But the bigger risk is the swing. And maybe, Kelby, you can just elaborate a little bit on why the swings matter. You know, for example, if you've got a 38-degree winter day and the next day is minus 10, why is that different than, you know, a stretch of days where you're at 8 degrees and then you're at minus 10?
Yeah, I mean, when you're dealing with swings that extreme, you're starting to play around the point where the vines are trying to respond to the weather. I mean, they're always responding to some extent, but when it's that cold, if you know, if the example you gave, if it's been 8 degrees or kind of as cold as the not this winter, but the one before was, the vines just kind of go into a dormant, super cooled state in some ways that we don't even fully understand yet, but they just stay there and kind of can handle any, you know, a 10 degree swing at that point doesn't really phase them one way or the other unless it's really extremely cold. Whereas when you're getting above the freezing point, when you're asking the vines to start responding physiologically to what's happening in their environment, and then you get a swing like that, you know, if they're starting to unpack themselves for spring and then all of a sudden the weather wants them to be ready for midwinter, it's just a nightmare. I mean, there's a great, Cornell actually put out a great graph just earlier this year of some research they'd done on what temperature was bud mortality at 50% every day of the winter for a different vine. And you can see it makes a little U-shaped curve where at the start of the winter, it doesn't take very cold weather to kill the buds. And then in midwinter, it really, you know, kind of they bottom out and they can really take a cold temperature. And then they sharply swing back up once it warms up in the spring. And even within that data, they had a year that they more or less, they didn't throw out, they included it. But it was a year, I think it might have been 12, I can't remember, where there was a huge early warm-up, and it just threw everything off kilter.
All right, a couple more questions. Richard, by the way, follows up by email. He says, I appreciate the winemaker sharing their answers. I got to try their wines. And he says, will they be available for purchase somewhere beyond the wineries themselves? Of course, Richard. You can get Finger Lakes Dry Rosés just about anywhere they're selling wine these days. And that's the good news, but Derek emails and wants to know, why aren't more local restaurants carrying Finger Lakes wines, rosé or otherwise? That's from Derek. Why don't I start with Peter Beecraft on this one? You want to address that one?
Ooh, snap, Derek. Yeah, good job. That's a good question. I think maybe they take us for granted in a way. Maybe they still are living off of the older preconceptions about quality of the wine. Maybe The quality of the restaurant is one that they would like to get bigger, you know, turn in a profit, get bigger box wines from another state. I don't know. It's one of those things that is changing. I think the Rochester scene is coming around faster than the Syracuse scene as a whole in terms of restaurants. You know, there's some really choice restaurants in Syracuse that are supporting Finger Lake Wines with winemakers' dinners and also bringing in the wine. So it's changing. It's changing, but it's, you know, he's got a point.
Well, Derek, that's a question that I think is going to change year by year. I mean, you're certainly seeing Finger Lakes Wines ending up in other markets, as Peter and Julia and Kelby have been telling us this hour. You're seeing more of, more of an awareness and a kind of a customer campaign in Rochester and in the Finger Lakes. I mean, the Finger Lakes probably should have even more than you find in restaurants, and you're starting to see more and more. But we're losing the hour here, so let me ask Kelby Russell, the winemaker for Red Newt Cellars and his own label, KJR, to jump in and tell us one more time what is coming up on Saturday, June 4th. It's the Rosé Soirée, and Kelby, set the scene. What's going to happen from 5 to 9?
It's going to be a great night of about 28 different wineries. We'll each have their rosé for the year that they'll be pouring samples of for ticket holders. There will also be the option to buy by the glass or by the bottle. Have lots of nice pink bedecked chairs and tables and tablecloths. The idea is really to make it almost like a picnic atmosphere. We want people to come down, not just enjoy the rosés, but also enjoy the whole evening. You know, not just come and leave, but be able to spread out, have some food from some of the restaurants, listening to music, hanging out with friends, hanging out with winemakers. It's just a good time. I think that's the key to its success.
And Kelby, if people have not been to Linden Street before, shame on them, as I've been saying, but it is where in Geneva? Just remind our listeners where this is.
Boy, it is smack dab in the middle of Geneva. It's a little one-way street, right? It cuts in between, 14 North and 14 South, as it turns out, right in downtown Geneva. You can't really miss it. There are a couple big parking lots on either side of the street, not on the street itself, but just off it. So there's plenty of parking around. It's easy to walk there, and you'll see streams of people heading towards it.
And Kelby, if people show up without a ticket for the Rosé Soirée on June 4th at 5 o'clock, are they going to get in?
They are going to get in. I mean, there are 50 tickets at the door, and then there'll be some you can always buy by the glass at Microclimate and wander the street.
All right, so there you go. So that's how you can get involved on Saturday, June 4th for the Rosé Soirée, third annual. One of the best events of the year, if not the best event of the year for the Finger Lakes wine industry. Kelby Russell, the winemaker for Red Newt Cellars, and KJR, thank you so much for taking the time, Kelby.
Thank you.
Julia Hoyle, assistant winemaker at Sheldrake Point Winery. Julia, great talking to you.
Same here.
And Peter Beecraft, head winemaker of Anthony Road Wine Company. Always a pleasure. Thanks, Peter.
Yeah, thanks for your support, Evan.
You got it. And thanks to our friends and colleagues down at WEOS, Finger Lakes Public Radio, 89.5 FM, where a lot of our listeners listen today and every day. They are media sponsors of the Rosé Soirée and great partners and friends as well. So Kelly, Greg, and the whole crew, thank you. Our thanks to Catch Wars and everyone else right here in Rochester. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk to you tomorrow.